Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Inconvenient Journalist by Dusko Doder with Louise Branson. Narrated by Julian Elfer. Prologue. The Assassination. Assassinations come in different guises. Mine was in the form of a phone call, its unfamiliar British ring echoing through the rented house on London's outskirts. My second wife, our two sons, and I were pre-Christmas snowbound. I remember picking it up, wondering who could possibly be calling us. Who even knew this number? The agent who had rented us the house? Yes, I said, looking through the gap in the chintz curtains at snow blanketing the neighbouring houses ranged along the narrow Barnet streets. Daddy, look at me, little Tommy said. He was firing a cap gun. Bang, bang, he said, pointing it at me, laughing as his baby brother looked on a little bewildered. After 2 years of reporting and writing about the violent disintegration of Yugoslavia, it was paradise to be on vacation in this warm and quiet house. I thought there was nothing better in the world than to sit with Louise and watch our two boys play. Dusko, have I tracked you down? The voice on the phone startled me. Bob Kaiser, the new managing editor of the Washington Post, didn't fit into this time, this place. His next sentence divided my life in two. Time magazine, he said, was preparing a story for the 1992 Christmas issue, suggesting I had become a Soviet agent while serving as the Post's bureau chief in Moscow. What? This did not make sense. That's total bullshit, I shouted into the telephone receiver. A lump rose in my throat. I could barely breathe. Kaiser interrupted me. I know. I think we can still stop the story, but you've got to talk to Time. They're insisting. I have nothing to talk to them about, I said. What's going on? Louise was trying to calm Nicholas as I hung up the phone. He seemed to react to my bewilderment and rage. His wail grew louder, louder, as if he were screaming at the world, at his impotence as more powerful beings took control of his life. The phone rang again. Ben Bradley, the former Post editor, was offering encouragement. You sure got some friends at Langley, pal, he said. His hunch was that the CIA was behind this. Retribution, he said, before breaking the transatlantic connection, is not carried out unconsciously or unknowingly, and they sure know how to do it. His words affirmed what my gut was already telling me. This was about the scoop that had embarrassed the top CIA brass. The story I had filed from Moscow on February 10, 1984, indicating that Soviet leader Yuri Andropov might have died. I had chosen my words carefully at the time, listing sudden TV programming changes, a switch to funereal classical music, lights blazing at midnight at KGB headquarters, and other strategic buildings. Bradley, excited but jittery in his Washington office, had asked top US officials for more information, and then scheduled the story for page one. Instead of validating it, the CIA checked with its operatives in Moscow, who said, Doder must be smoking pot. It was late at night by the time this was relayed to a Post editor, and Bradley had already gone home. Without consulting Bradley, the editor removed the story from the front page, but kept it deep inside the paper for its later editions. After the story proved correct, the Post and other newspapers ran stories praising my reporting and questioning the competence of US intelligence. I spent much of that evening in December 1992 on the phone. Kaiser called several times. He was trying to persuade Time executives that their reporter had been set up, played. You have to talk to them, Kaiser said during our last conversation. I still hope we can stop them. Okay, I said, grasping at the straw Kaiser held out. Journalism was about the truth. I just had to refute everything, point by point. But Kaiser's I think had now become I hope. I had an awful foreboding that nothing was going to work out, that Time merely wanted to create the appearance of fairness by entertaining my account of events in 1984. A million silent arguments rattled around in my head. Why now? Who? I could think of no more grievous blow to myself, to any journalist, than impugning his or her patriotism and integrity. The attack was especially painful for an immigrant like myself who had worked long and hard to achieve the American dream I had fantasized about and that had motivated my escape from communist Yugoslavia. As I played out scenarios in the now ominous quiet of the London rental, I resolved to sue Time for libel. The truth would be told, if not in the magazine, then in court. But Louise, I thought, didn't deserve to be dragged into a long legal fight against Time Warner with its vast legal and financial resources. That night, I told her that she must take the two boys and separate from me. She was young, successful in her career with the London Sunday Times. If I live to be 100 years old, I'll never forget her quiet grace, the way she looked at me and shook her head. "What are you talking about? I'm your wife. We fight this together." She, like me, understood that all we had, as reporters and people, were our reputations. In the morning, I did what I had to do. I phoned my attorney in Washington, Mitchell Rogovin, and instructed him to immediately serve notice on Time that I would sue them for libel if they printed this false story. The next few days were a blur. Bradley called a few more times, I had long talks with Rogovin, Post colleagues, scandalized because they knew my work, started collecting money for my legal defense fund. When I heard this, my heart leapt momentarily. Yet I felt oddly restless and dislocated. My self-doubt, my lack of faith in my own capacities, had grown quickly like a tumor. I was beginning to fear I'd be unable to cope. I realized that I was at severe risk of losing my good name. Days before Christmas, Kaiser faxed an advance copy of the Time story. I was shocked. A photo of me, smug and arrogant, had been selected to make a clear editorial point. I knew a hatchet job when I saw one. I felt myself being killed not by an assassin's single bullet, but slowly, the poison of the falsehood starting to spread throughout my body. I anticipated the weeks and months of predictable awfulness that would follow. I'd ceased to exist for my friends and colleagues. We celebrated Christmas with Louise's parents at their home in her family's ancestral village in the Buckinghamshire countryside. In turmoil inside, I went through the motions, pulling British Christmas crackers, nodding as my father-in-law, a conservative local politician, lamented Princess Diana's divorce from Prince Charles that year. "Daddy, don't be sad," three-year-old Tommy said as he climbed onto my lap. He was a lovely boy. I was touched. I'd be able to tell him my story one day, I thought. How I had dedicated myself to journalism, believing that telling the truth, no matter where it led or who it exposed, was my calling. I would share with Tommy and his brother Nicholas that I had always held in my head and my heart what Thomas Jefferson wrote, that if he had to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, he would choose the latter. I had reported the truth in service of that mission and out of a belief in American values and the First Amendment that protects the freedom of the press and free speech. Always I had been certain I was both special and protected. How wrong I had been. 1. The Story That Died. 24 years earlier, long before I could imagine working for the Washington Post, let alone being the target of a reputational hit job, I stepped into the bar of the Sheraton Carpenter Hotel in Manchester, New Hampshire. At the time, I was a young reporter, still married to my first wife. Warmth enveloped me. I felt grateful to be out of the swirling February New England snow. I scanned the room for my friend, Bill Dunphy. His family owned this hotel. The bar was where I usually found him. The bar room still felt familiar with its sleek, modern, recessed lighting, scattered tables, the smell of whiskey and cigarette smoke. I was passing through Manchester now, but I had worked here months earlier as a reporter for the Associated Press wire service. As I sought out Dunphy, the way I held myself with an incongruous mix of hesitancy and cockiness no doubt conveyed who I was, a journalist who was chafing at being in a junior role. Though I had moved up a notch from New Hampshire to the bigger AP bureau in Albany, I was impatient to fulfill my outsized ambition of becoming a famous journalist. I picked out Dunphy's tall, gaunt figure through swirls of cigarette smoke seconds before he saw me. It was time enough for me to register that he was in a heated argument. Dunphy was gesticulating, his finger jabbing at the air. That was so unlike him, I thought. It must be something serious. I recognized the distinguished-looking man with receding iron-gray hair who was the subject of his anger. Senator Tom McIntyre, Dunphy's fellow Democratic Party grandee and fellow Irish-American. "Dusko!" Dunphy beckoned me over. He bear-hugged me and his face lit up. "You know Senator McIntyre, of course?" "Of course." We shook hands. Their tension remained. I sat down, ordered a scotch. Their argument picked right back up. Dunphy resumed pressing McIntyre.
"Sample complete. Ready to continue?